Good morning, everyone, and welcome to week three of the series, Six Lessons in Jewish History. So first of all, a couple of things before we start. I just want to, in case I forget at the end, I just want to remind everyone again about our raffle that we're doing now, which I know many of you already participated. Thank you for that. And it is a significant fundraiser that we do every year. So if you can, see the office afterwards or and participate as best as you can and spread the word if you can as well. Second of all, I'm just going to apologize in advance. I'm probably going to finish a couple of minutes early and then sort of rush off because I have to jump on another Zoom to do a presentation in New York. Not in New York, I mean in Sydney, but... What's that? Yes, that's right, that's right. So I'm going to go upstairs and do it in my office, but I'll just have to just get set up, so I'll be a couple of minutes. Actually, it's funny, I'm doing actually two things in New York, and the guy who I'm doing it for today WhatsApped me yesterday, says, I see you presenting in Muncie, New York on Sunday night. Are you in New York? I said, I don't know, it's also online. All right. So just a bit of review from last week. Last week we talked about Rabbi Akiva. And we talked basically about three points coming out of Rabbi Akiva. The one was the growth mindset, the believing in one's own ability to grow and others' ability to grow, not being defined by one's current status, not being defined by one's talents, and so on and so forth. That was the first, and that was Rabbi Akiva, who at 40 started learning and grew to one of the greatest sages. The second point we talked about is looking at the bigger picture. Rabbi Akiva was that one who said, whatever happens is for the good, whatever God does is for the good. That was the story of the rooster and the hen, the donkey and the candle and so on. He was one who smiled rather than cried when they saw the temple in ruins because he saw the growing in the destruction. And he always saw in every challenge, he saw the opportunity. And the last point we talked about Rabbi Akiva was the education being the key to continuity. And that's why he gave his life for teaching Torah, even when the Romans prohibited it and tried to shut down religious survival through prohibiting learning, and he went ahead anyway. Okay, so today we're going to go to a different period. Now, I'm not going in a particular order. I'll just choose a period each week. So we start with King David, went to Rabbi Akiva, and now we're going even more backwards. So today I'm going to actually talk about the three leaders that took us out of Egypt, Moshe, Moses, Aaron, his brother, and Miriam. A fascinating combination, actually, and worth exploring. So there's been many times where we've shared lessons, particularly from the leadership experience of Moshe Rabbeinu, Moses. So I'm going to do a little bit of that today, but actually I'm going to focus more on his brother Aaron and his sister Miriam, because they do go together. In fact, that's not just something I made up or not just something that comes out of the history story, but the Talmud makes a point of saying this. The Talmud says that the Jewish people, when they came out of Egypt, meaning when they came out of Egypt and became a nation and so on, they had three, what the Talmud refers to as parnasim, providers, in other words, three leaders. Obviously, Moses was the primary leader, but there were really three leaders in a way, and they were Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. We also find in the Talmud an interesting thing, which we'll mention now and come back to a bit later, that the Jews, when they left Egypt and wandered through the desert throughout the 40 years, they were given three gifts. The first was the gift of the manna that fell from heaven as sustenance. The second was the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory. That was the clouds that, spiritual clouds that enveloped them and surrounded them, which provided for them protection, flattened the mountains, killed the snakes and scorpions as they were traveling, and so on and so forth. And then the Be'er, the well, the water, which provided water while they were in the desert. So the Talmud says that the Anane HaKavod, the clouds of glory, came in the merit of Aaron. The man, the manna from heaven, came in the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu. And the Be'er, the well, the special well, the miraculous well that provided water throughout the whole camp and traveled with them, came in the merits of Miriam. Interestingly enough, the towards the end of their stay in the desert, Miriam passed away and Aaron passed away. And those things, the two things in their merit disappeared, but they came back afterwards with the prayers of Moshe Rabbeinu and the merit of Moshe Rabbeinu. So Moshe Rabbeinu, in his own right, was able to bring back the other two as well, but the primary connection of the clouds was to Aaron, and the primary connection to the water was to Miriam. Just an interesting piece of general knowledge, there's a mystical tradition that on Motzei Shabbat, when Shabbos comes out, there are many people that have a custom to make a hot drink, a tea or whatever the case is, using fresh water. So not water that was ready in the kettle, but using fresh water to boil up new water, fresh water, and drink it. And the reason for that is because the sages tell us that on Motzei Shabbat, all the wells of the world are all connected to the well of Miriam. And that's why there's this concept of I just thought I'd mention that because it's interesting. Okay. So we'll come back to this later, but let's first start just a little bit contrasting or comparing Moshe and Aaron, Moshe and his brother Aaron. We mentioned this before, but there's a verse in Tehillim upon which there's commentary that tells us that when God created the world, he created it with two attributes, chesed and emet, kindness and truth, right? Moshe Rabbeinu, who was Moshe Rabbeinu, the teacher, the instructor, the person who taught us the Torah, he represents the values of the Torah, he represents truth, the truth of the Torah. Where Aaron, we know, he's known as the Kohen, he was the Kohen Gadol, the high priest. Kabbalistically, Kohanim are connected with Chesed. He was known as the Kohen Shel Chesed, Isha Chesed, and he was the person who loved peace and pursues peace. So how do these two things play out together? How do they work, and how do they work together in this case of Aaron and Moshe? A really, really important combination. Right? So let me base it on a famous passage in a Mishnah in the Ethics of the Fathers. The Ethics of the Fathers tells us that one should always try to be a disciple of Aaron. That's what it says. Hevei mitalmidav shel Aaron. Be a disciple of Aaron. What does that mean? Love peace, says the Perkei Avot. Pursue peace. He was a lover of peace. He pursued peace. Or hevet habriyot. He loved creations, meaning he loved people. And umekarvan la Torah, brought them close to the teachings of the Torah. So there's a very, very famous concept in this about, first of all, what does it mean he loved peace, right? So there's a famous idea that from one of the sources where we learn that it's okay to lie for the sake of peace, a white lie in certain circumstances, even though the Torah plays an amazing value on truth, but nevertheless, we know there's room to, we learn it from different sources. One of them is Aaron. So they tell about Aaron, they say that he loved peace so much so that he'd always resolve conflict between two people. And what he did was he lied. What would he do? He would, if two people were in conflict, husband and wife or two friends, he would go to each one privately and make up a fib, he would make up a story. And he would tell them that, you know, I spoke to your partner, your friend, and he or she really wants to make up with you, but just too embarrassed. And then he would go to the other one and he'd make up the same story. And then they would meet, somehow he would orchestrate, they would meet somewhere in the marketplace, on the street, and they would reconnect. Yeah. So, on one level, the simple level of this is that he lied. He just lied. And it's okay, because to make peace, it's okay to lie, right? Because Gadol HaShalom, the greatness of peace, is unbelievable. Peace is a source of blessing. And we find that even God sort of changed the truth a bit for peace. We learn that from the story of Abraham and Sarah, where Sarah laughed when the angels promised her a son the coming year. And God wanted to know why she laughed, but she didn't. He changed the story a bit, not to put Sarah in a bad light in order not to create conflict between Abraham and Sarah. So yeah, so on the simple level, it is okay to lie in order. And the Gemara and the Talmud gives instances where it's okay to change the truth. Obviously, one shouldn't jump into this. One shouldn't do this mitzvah with tremendous excitement because, you know, always blame everything on the sake of peace, right? There are guidelines and there are contexts where that can be done. But that's the point. The point is it's okay to lie in order to create peace. However, I want sort of a deeper explanation. And the deep explanation is that Aaron actually never lied. It was true. Now, what does it mean it was true? It wasn't true. Two people were fighting like cats and dogs. What do you mean it was true? Right? So he made up a story that they want to make peace, but it was actually true. Why was it actually true? So let's go back to this passage that the Pirkei Avot says. It says he loved peace and he pursued peace and he loved people, right? But it doesn't say people. It has a very strange expression, which you mentioned before. It says, Ohevet Habriyot, he liked creations. What does that mean? So the commentators explain that what it means is he liked even those type of people which didn't seem to have many redeeming qualities, right? He liked them. Why? He loved them because they were created by God. They were creations, that's it. That was good enough. And that's what it means, Ohevet Habriyot, which is in itself an amazing thing. In other words, everyone has value. The fact they're created by God means that they are valuable. But on a deeper level, what it means is this. The fact that they were created by God meant that deep down, they had tremendous good. It meant that Aaron understood that even when people mess up, as we've spoken about many, many times, the failures of the human being are superficial. They're important. They need to be done. They need to be dealt with. They need to be taken responsible. We need to take responsibility for them and we need to fix them, but they're only superficial. Deep down, there's goodness. Deep down, there's purity. In other words, when Aaron looked at two people fighting and fighting for no reason and in deep, embroiled in conflict, he saw, when he saw them, he saw that we're created by God. It doesn't only mean that he saw they're created by God and therefore the fact they're created by God gives them value. No. He saw that we're created by God, so he saw the inner essence of the human being. He didn't see a person fighting. What he saw the depth of the individual. He saw the person that wants to make up. And therefore, when he went to the other person and he said, you know, your friend really wants to make up with you, he was actually telling the truth. Not on the superficial level. He was telling the truth is that it was true. He really believed that. He honestly believed that. You know, just in the last week, I've been reading a book that I'm sure me and among other people are one of the biggest supporters of Gold's Bookstore. But so I walked in there the other day with my daughter to buy her a book, and out of a corner of my eye, I noticed a new book which I couldn't resist. So I bought. That was happening, but this happens every time I walk in there. So, so I saw a book, and it was a book about an individual which I've a long time ago I mentioned actually. It's an amazing, amazing person. His name is Rabbi Grossman. He lives in Migdal Emek in the north of Israel, in the Galil, in the north of Israel. He's a person who, after the Six-Day War, decided. Did I ever tell you, he was known as the. There was a documentary many, many years about him. He was called. He's called the Disco Rabbi. No, never heard of him. Oh, so let me just tell you. Sorry.
I missed the first bit.
Disco Rabbi. Yeah. Why is it called Disco Rabbi? Because he was. It's an amazing thing. I recommend the book. It's the most incredible stories. He and I've known about him, and I've always been fascinated about him. He's a person. He was born in Meir Sharim. He was born in Jerusalem. Meir Sharim, which is probably one of the most insular Orthodox communities that exist, right? I'm talking about not only just the Haredi community, but it's people there that have very little connection to the outside world. And his father was a Yerushalmi, his grandparents were Yerushalmi, they're all like very much part of that world. And he had this unbelievable, and he was a very talented guy, he learned, and he was a great, a very pious sort of person, a religious person. And he had this, and he got married, then he had this feeling after the Six-Day War that he needs to do something for the nation of Israel, right? That because he wants to thank God. He went to the Kotel the first time, and he was very emotional. And cried. Anyway, long story short, he a great saintly Rebbe, the Lelever Rebbe, told him, why don't you go up to Migdal HaEmek, which is a city in Israel, Galilee, and see what you can help, see what you can do. So he traveled there. Now, he didn't even know what Migdal HaEmek was. At that time, Migdal HaEmek was a very, socioeconomically, it was a very, very poor place. It was a very crime-ridden area. All the problem kids were there and so on and so forth. So just to tell you a little bit about it. So he arrives there and he wants to check out the town. So he stops someone and says, Where's the yeshiva here in town? The guy looks at him like he's mad. What yeshiva? There's no yeshiva. Where's the cheder? He says, no cheder. So he says, so where are the kids? He says, the kids on the disco. He didn't know what a disco was. He thought a disco was like another form of yeshiva or something, right? So this is where he tells the story. So he goes and he finds it and it's like, and he finds like, all, and he gets introduced. Anyway, he gets to work, right? I mean, this guy over the years, a long story, he's written, it's a very thick book. I mean, some of the stories I've heard from him before, I once heard him speak in South Africa. He built up an empire, an unbelievable empire. He made, what one person can do is just fascinating, right? But the reason I'm bringing it up now is because When he went and he started to live there, his father, understandably so, was a bit worried. He says, are you sure this is like the right thing for you? Right? He was a young guy, very young guy. He was early 20s. He got married very early. And his father, who was a big Rosh Hashiva, was understandably a bit worried about his young son, just married, going to a very permissive city, a very crime-ridden city, a very irreligious city. And I guess in the back of his mind, I mean, he knew his son was a good guy, but like, he said, you know, there's all these type of people there. I mean, aren't you afraid you're going to... So he said to his father, I want you to know, and this is from the bottom of his heart, and this played out his whole life. He said, when I see them, I don't see the people. I see the souls. So he said. And he meant it. And he meant it because that was his philosophy. And he did, I mean, he's brought thousands of people back to Judaism on different levels. Thousands, literally thousands from the down in the dumps, right? I mean, he built up a whole empire, people and so on, but... And it's always with tremendous love. He was like, he's a real Aaron, this guy. Like, always with love. Always because never shies away from a person, never writes someone off. The stories the book tells, one of the most crazy stories of people, real mafia type people, and who knows, people that got mixed up in wrong crowds and really got into trouble, and he helps them out. And he started a whole thing in the prisons where he started like a yeshiva in the prison where he'd give shiurim in the prison, a whole network of things. And has brought so many people back and rehabilitated so many people. Why? Because Ohevet Abriyot, he sees the potential. It's an amazing thing, right? So that's the starting point, and that's why Aaron is such an important figure in Jewish history. And in fact, the Torah tells us an amazing thing. The Torah says that when he passed away and when Moses passed away, there was a different response. Moses was truth. Moses was instruction. Moses had to give it the way it was. When it says that when Moses passed away, the Jews cried for 30 days. When Aaron passed away, before that, they cried for 60 days. And it says, Kol Beit Yisrael, everyone cried. No exception with Moshe Rabbeinu, there were some exceptions. Why? Because of his thing. However, having said that, this is the starting point, right? This is why the partnership is such an important partnership. The starting point definitely is Aaron. You've got to see the person. You've got to see the soul. You've got to see the potential. You've got to see their inner willingness to do the right thing. You've got to see the willingness to make up with the other person. That's why when he told people this lie that they wanted to make up, it wasn't really lying. He really meant it. He believed it. He believed that deep down that's what they wanted. But on the other hand, of course, you need Moshe Rabbeinu. Love alone is not going to do it. It's a starting point. It's a foundation. You need instruction. You need values. You need to reveal what's hidden. And to reveal what's hidden means you need to take that intrinsic goodness and nurture it, channel it, expose it to proper values, proper understanding, proper information, proper education. And that's why the partnership of Moshe and Aaron are so vital, because I guess the lesson for us is we need to try and achieve both. Again, going back to this book, you see this is very much a combination of how this Rabbi Grossman operated all his life, or he's still operating, right? Where you've got to start with the unconditional love, but then eventually you've got to be able to teach, and you've got to be able to bring someone to understand and to be on a conscious level exposed to the good values and spiritual values and so on and so forth. And with that, everyone is different, and everyone needs to be instructed differently. Which also explains what I said before, explains why the clouds of glory came in the merit of Aaron, whereas the manna from heaven, food, came from Moshe Rabbeinu. Why? So some of the commentaries explain the following idea. Protection is an all-encompassing thing. Every Jew that was traveling in the desert under the protection of the clouds of glory were protected equally. That's why it came in the merit of Aaron. Because the Aaron, the honor differences, the Aaron concept, the Aaron contribution, where you just see everyone's soul, all the souls are the same. All the souls are infusion of godliness. All the souls are pure. Moshe Rabbeinu's job then was to nurture that and to reveal it through education, through truth, and through true values. That everyone's different. That's like food. Not everyone eats the same way. Right? Not everyone can eat this. Not everyone digests the same way. Not everyone processes food the same way. That's very different from person to person. That's why the clouds of glory, the protection, came from Aaron, whereas the food comes from Moses. Okay, so that's the kindness. Now, just going back to Aaron for a moment, kindness, when we talk about kindness and love that people have for others, like in the case of Aaron, it doesn't always come the same way. Some people are very generous or very kind, but the kindness happens on a different level. In other words, sometimes people are amazingly kind, but it's because they want to be kind, right? There's something very, very special about Aaron's kindness that was incredibly selfless, right? What I'm saying is the following. Sometimes people are very, very kind as long as you do it their way, right? As long as you don't touch the ego. In other words, in fact, some of the time you find with people that are very, very kind out there, will do amazing things for other people, but don't have such good relationships themselves because in the inner circle, they're problematic, right? They don't like people stepping on their toes. They don't like people getting in their way. We find an amazing thing with Aaron that is worth mentioning while we're talking about his kindness. And that is a conversation which God had with Moses at the burning bush, right? Where he asked him to go to Egypt and become the leader of the Jewish people. Because again, I mean, clearly Moses was the main leader of the Jewish people, right? Moses resists, right? For many reasons. Moses was humble. He didn't think it was worthy. And then Moses puts up a really good argument. He says, I got a brother. My brother's older than me. Worthier than me, right? And Moses was very sensitive to that. So I'm going to come back to Egypt. I've got a brother who's been there for a while. I've been out of Egypt for a long time. He's been suffering together with my Jewish brethren. And he deserves it. He should get the mantle, which is great on Moses' part. He was worried about how Aaron would feel. So God tells Moshe Rabbeinu, you have nothing to worry about. Not only you have nothing to worry about, but this is what's going to happen. When you go back to Egypt and you meet Aaron, you tell him what your mission is, he said three words, God said. V'ra'acha v'samach b'libo. He's going to see you and he's going to rejoice in his heart. He's going to be happy for you. Right? That's an amazing attribute. And I think what we're talking about Aaron, if we're learning lessons from that period in Jewish history, we really need to mention this because I think you find this by Aaron more than by other people. In other words, you find this amazing thing that Aaron not only had no problem with Moses becoming the leader, not only wasn't he upset that he was the leader, but he was happy for Moses, genuinely happy, right? And that's the sign of true selfless love and true selfless kindness. To not only be generous to others, not only control the process of generosity and philanthropic and kindness and giving to others, but actually to rejoice in the success of others, even when it means taking away from your potential success. That's big. And that was Aaron. Aaron, that's why he singled out for this concept. He singled out for this lover of peace and pursuer of peace. And the Ohev et Abriyo, because he truly loved every human being to the point where it wasn't about him at all. In other words, it was generosity, it was kindness together with humility, which is an incredible thing. Now, that's about Aaron and Moses. However, I wanted to focus a little bit on Miriam. Maybe some of what Miriam stood for is not that famous, but really it should be because it's an incredibly powerful part of the leadership team of the Jewish people as they left Egypt, and even before they left Egypt. So what did Miriam stand for? Remember, the water came in the schut of Miriam. So the same commentary that explained the connection between the manna from heaven to Moses and the protection to Aaron explained that food, when a person eats food, I'm not a doctor or a physicist, but apparently this is what happens, right? When you eat food, the reason why it's important to drink after you eat is because the drink helps you digest the food, apparently, right? Is that true? Yeah, I'm assuming so. It carries the food to different parts of the body, helps you process the food that you drink, right? I tell you, some people say you're not supposed to drink while you eat, but after you eat, you're supposed to drink. In fact, Halakha says that, right? You know how we bench, so when we bench after eating, it's based on a verse which says, you shall eat and become satisfied, then you shall bless God. So the Talmud says, you shall eat, that's food. You should become satisfied, that's water. When you drink water, you drink liquid at the end of a meal. Okay. What's that got to do with Miriam? So Miriam, in a very, you could say, typical feminine form, right, was the female of this group, brought things down to a practical level. You know, our rabbis tell us that Bishut Emunah, it was the merit of faith in God that the Jewish people left Egypt, right? What does this mean? Because we know that, I mean, on the surface, what it's saying is the following. We know that when the Jews left Egypt, they were a very assimilated bunch, right? They had become, I mean, they were there for 210 years. They weren't very spiritual, most of them. And in fact, even copied the ways, even the pagan ways, the pagan worship ways of the Egyptians. And they were what God referred to as naked of mitzvot. They didn't have much to go, they didn't have much for them, right? In fact, the Talmud talks about a conversation that happened in heaven where the angels confronted God and said, why are you saving this nation over that nation? They both not really that great, right? So that's a whole other discussion in its own right. But what did they have? So the rabbis tell us, b'schuta emuna, it was in the merit of faith. They believed. Ultimately, when Moses came, they believed, and they believed that they were going to leave Egypt, right? But we are taught that that belief, interestingly enough, was far stronger by the women than it was by the men. And that was in the merit of Miriam. Miriam was the one to create that, right? Miriam was the one because that's a very feminine concept. When you take something that exists in the potential and you process it and you make something out of it, right? We've talked about this before, the difference between masculine energy and feminine energy. So mystically, that's why Miriam stands for this feminine concept where the emunah could be in a very masculine way, it could be in a very potential way. It's theoretical, it's philosophical, it's abstract. And yes, I believe, but do I live the belief, right? Do I actually, can I internalize that belief? And Miriam, the belief and hope, and Miriam all along stood for that, right? And she did that with two almost opposite character traits. I'm going to take you through it because it's a beautiful lesson. Miriam, on the one hand, was very nurturing. She's known as a very, very nurturing person, which the nurturing aspect of her is somewhat of a soft nature, nurturing nature, right? She was a midwife, actually, in the very beginning of the Egyptian slavery. And I'll tell you about that in a minute, right? But she would help people, she would support people, she was a nurturing person. That's what. But she was also a person of tremendous strength when she needed to be, right? So the first time we encounter Miriam in the Torah was way, way, way before the Jews left Egypt. She was a young girl at the time, helping her mother Yocheved. And in fact, she has a different name when we first see her. We need the Talmud's oral law to explain to us who it is. But we encounter at the very beginning of the story of the Jewish slavery when Pharaoh enacted the decrees of slavery against the Jewish people, we encounter two women by the name of Shifra and Pua. Who was Shifra and Pua? We are told Shifra was Yocheved, Miriam's mother, and Pua was Yocheved herself. Was Miriam herself, sorry. Right? So Miriam's mother, I mean Yocheved, and then Pua was Miriam. So they were summoned by Pharaoh, who told them that when they go and help the Jewish women give birth, they are to see if it's a girl or a boy, and if it's a boy, they need to kill them. Right? Now, why Shifra and Pua? It wasn't their real name. Shifra was, comes to the word l'shaper, to make beautiful. She would make beautiful children. She would clean them up. And Pua was also more like sort of, she would sing to the baby. She would be nurturing. Pua is a like soften, calm things down. That's what Pua stands for, right? So that was Miriam's nature. But at the same time, Miriam had this very strong nature. And from a very, very young girl, she knew that it was her job to have hope against all odds. It was her job to make sure that there was going to be the continuity of the Jewish people. And therefore, she and her mother stood up to Pharaoh and risked their own lives and didn't carry out the decree. Went ahead with their normal business, helped the women give birth, they were midwives, and business is normal. After a while, Pharaoh sees what's going on, so he summons them, and he says, why are you not doing this? They make up some story. They make up that the Jewish women are like animals. They give birth before we get there, it's already done. They don't need midwives. So we're always too late. That was the story they made up. Anyway, God rewarded them, a whole story. So that was Miriam. So what did Pharaoh do? And this is, again, continues the story of Miriam. So Pharaoh enacts another decree. And this was a decree that the Egyptians, because he couldn't trust them, of course, so the decree was, the famous decree, that all male-born children need to be thrown into the river. Right? So the Talmud tells a fascinating story. And the fascinating story is that Amram and Yocheved, Miriam's parents, who already had two children, Miriam and Aaron, separated. They figured, why have children? If children are going to be thrown into the river, why have children? The problem was that Amram, Miriam's parents, Amram and Yocheved, were very well-known, prominent figures in the Jewish community. So they separated, so others followed suit. Right? So little Miriam, who was a child at the time, if you calculate the years, went to her father and said to her father, Amram, again, this was her thing, right? She said to her father, Amram, your decree is worse than Pharaoh's. She said, why? He said, first of all, Pharaoh's decree either is going to work or not work. Maybe not all children will be shot and thrown into the river, maybe some will survive. And second of all, Pharaoh's decree is only on boys. Your decree is definitely going to work. People separate, they're not going to have children. And it's going to kill the boys and the girls. Essentially, you're ending the Jewish nation. So, and then it says that Miriam was a prophetess from a very young age, and she says that I can see in a prophecy that you're going to give birth to a very, very important person and a savior of the Jewish people. So Amram and Yocheved listen, and they get back together, and of course everyone else follows suit. And a number of months later, Moshe Rabbeinu is born. Moshe Rabbeinu is born, the decree is still fully, he was born prematurely, which says in the Chumash, you know, I don't know if you know that, Moshe Rabbeinu was born 3 months early, right, yeah. Just a bit of important Jewish knowledge, right? Why is that relevant to the story? Because it says in the Chumash that Yocheved hid him for 3 months. Why was she able to hide him? Because the Egyptians used to keep tabs on when people got back together or people married. And they would come check in 9 months to see if anyone was born, right? So when they realized that Yocheved and Amram remarried, so to speak, they were planning to visit in 9 months, but Moshe Rabbeinu was born 3 months early, so she hid him for 3 months and that was okay. Then the Pasuk says that the 9 months came and she wasn't able to hide him. So she didn't know what to do. Because he was going to be found. So it says that Yocheved took Moshe Rabbeinu, put him in a basket and put him at the banks of the River Nile to float, right? At which point, Amram goes to his daughter, Miriam, and says, ha-ha, where's your prophecy? Right? Where's your prophecy? So it says Miriam went and she stood far away from where the basket was to see what's going to happen. She refused to give up. The story unfolds, as we know, as the Chumash tells us, that Batya, right? The daughter of Pharaoh, went down to the river to bathe. She came with her maidservants. She found the basket. She realized that it's a Jewish child. She realized that it's a Jewish child that was hungry. She didn't agree with her father. She tried to nurse him. He wouldn't nurse. Miriam was in the background. Miriam realized that there's something here about his holiness that he refuses to nurse from an Egyptian person. So she comes out of the reeds and she says, I see you trying to look for a nurse. Maybe I'll go and find a Jewish nurse, a Jewish wet nurse that will be able to nurse this child. Batya says, go. She runs and finds Yocheved, Moshe Rabbeinu's mother. She nursed him for 2 years, but after 2 years, she had to give him back. And he grew up in Pharaoh's palace. Right? That's the story of Moshe Rabbeinu. The point of the story is, and then of course, Amram realized where it was all going. Right? Now, I'm going to tell you another story where this plays out later. Just the power of not giving up on a child. Right? Similar to the Rabbi Grossman story I was telling before, symbolically about not giving up, even on a baby. Right? So, but before I tell you that story, This concept traveled through to all the other women of Egypt. That's why I said the women had more faith than the men. Because this was Miriam, right? Miriam essentially is really credited with the redemption of the Jewish people. Our existence depends on Miriam. Because she and the people who she influenced was primarily the women of Egypt refused to give up. And in fact, there's so many stories in Midrashim which are told about this. For example, we're told that the Jewish women, There was a whole story later in the desert, which I'll just share with you quickly. When they built the Mishkan, right? They built the Mishkan and Moses asked all the Jewish people to donate resources and materials for the building of the sanctuary, right? And the women gave what they had, and they had brought out of Egypt, it's an interesting story, they brought out of Egypt mirrors. Not mirrors like we have today, they were called copper mirrors. In other words, very shiny copper that you can look in and see your reflection, right? The mirrors that they had used in Egypt, right? And God told Moshe Rabbeinu to take all these copper mirrors and make one of the holiest vessels of the Mishkan from them. And Moshe Rabbeinu was a little bit surprised, like, mirrors are an important thing, but it's a very, you know, it's a mundane thing at the end of the day. Does it really belong, the mirrors really belong, be the material to make this the basin that the Kohanim would wash, purify their hands from to do the service in the Mishkan. And God said, absolutely, these are the best mirrors. These are the things I want to be the Mishkan. Why? What was the story behind these mirrors? Behind these mirrors were, says the Medrash, that the men were out working as slaves of Pharaoh. And they used to come back and they had no interest in their wives. That's what we're told, right? Which meant, on a deeper level, they had no interest in continuing on the Jewish nation. It was all very good that Amram and Yecheved got together, but most people actually, even when they got together, had no interest. They had lost interest. And it says that the women, this is what it says, I'm just telling you the way it says, the Jewish women would use these mirrors to make themselves extra attractive and particularly attractive, and they would lure their husbands. They would cook a dinner for the husband, they would lure them back for one reason only. To continue the Jewish nation, to make sure they'd still be a nation. And they risked their lives. And therefore the Midrash says that what used to happen is they would give birth, and then when they came time to give birth, there was another problem, because if it was a boy, they would be whisked away by the Egyptians. So eventually what happened was the Jewish mothers used to go to the orchards and give birth under the apple trees, and miraculously the angels used to come and whisk them away and return them back later. Which is why, if you look in the Song of Songs, King Solomon says one of the reasons we eat charoset on Pesach night, which are made of apples, because King Solomon says that the birth of the Jewish nation took place under the apple trees. That's where we were born as a nation. Why? Because of the belief and the hope and the not giving up of the women who got this from Miriam. Which then played out an interesting little thing. I'll tell you one more thing, and I'm going to share with you an amazing concept of what happened to Miriam afterwards. When the Jews left from Egypt, if you look in the Torah, you'll see an amazing thing. It says that they crossed the Red Sea, and after the Red Sea, they sang a song. Shira, sang a song, right? Az Yashir, it's part of our davening every day. It's a song that they sang to praise God, to thank God for being saved. After they finished the song, it says in the Torah that Miriam gathered all the women to sing separately, and they also sang a song. But it says it a bit differently. It says that Miriam gathered the women with tambourines and instruments. And they didn't just sing, they sang and they danced and they played instruments, right? Separate to the men. So the commentaries ask a question, like, where did they get these tambourines from? Right? And why did the men have the tambourines? And the answer is very simple. They packed up very quickly in a rush. You know, they were rushed when they left Egypt, right? Yes, they took gold and silver as resources, but they were rushed in terms of their own personal belongings. That's why we have matzah, because they don't have time to bake bread properly. But the women made sure to pack in one more item, the musical instruments. Why? Because they knew it was going to turn out okay. They knew it was just a matter of time. They knew that in a few days we were going to sing a song to God, so we should be prepared. The men weren't that. They were also sure, but not that sure. So they didn't take instruments. Why? All from Miriam. This is all led by Miriam. Because Miriam is the concept of faith, hope, and determination with strength. All those, not naive faith, not hope, that's just sort of a last resort. You know, that's also needs to be understood. Hope is something, or faith is something, that's not a crutch. Something like when all else fails, have hope, have faith. Right? You know, sometimes, I mean, it's also a good thing. Faith is always a good thing. But sometimes people try and achieve something and try and achieve great success and try to overcome hurdles and obstacles, and it doesn't seem to work. So, you know, okay, God will help. But God will help is not a last resort. God will help is everything. It's what should not come when the effort fails. It should be what inspires the effort to begin with. It sounds very different. And that was Miriam. Miriam, from a young age, nurtured with strength. She instilled hope, but with strength. If it's going to take an obstacle, it's going to take an obstacle. It's going to mean risk our lives, we'll risk our lives. If it means waiting to see why it's not working out and standing at a distance to see what's going to happen with this baby, which she knew was going to be okay, let's see, and it will turn out okay. That was Miriam. So strong, before we talk about the lesson of this, so strong was this faith that it played out many, many, many years later. I'm talking about over 100 years later, because she passed away when she was way past 100, right? Just to give you the calculation, so Moshe Rabbeinu was 80 years old when he took the Jewish people out of Egypt, and he passed away 40 years later at 120. Miriam was a couple of years older, so she passed away like 123, 124, somewhere like that. Okay. Later on, in fact, this comes from last week's parsha. Find a fascinating story. So let me share this insight with you. It's an amazing insight. So last week's, I don't know if you know the story, but last week's parsha, we have an incident where Miriam and Aaron actually said gossip against Moshe Rabbeinu. I don't know if that's a familiar story, but so it was a whole story. It had to do with Moshe Rabbeinu's marriage, actually. Now, it wasn't gossip in the simple sense of the word. It was gossip on a deep level. Miriam actually meant well. She felt that Moshe Rabbeinu was very into his prophecy and he was very holy. And after Matan Torah, he hadn't returned sort of to normal, proper married life. Unbeknown to them, it was actually under construction, under instruction of God, because he was always ready to speak to God. A whole story. Anyway, but she said something critical of Moshe Rabbeinu, which God was upset with. Right? That's what the Torah tells us, end of last week's parsha. God was upset with, and suddenly there was this revelation of God where God said that Moshe, Aaron, and Miriam need to go out to the Mishkan where there was going to be a revelation, and God chastised, he reprimanded Miriam and Aaron for doing that. He says, you don't understand who Moses is, and so on and so forth. Suddenly, as a punishment, they turn around and they see Miriam is completely covered with leprosy. We spoke about leprosy once before, right? That was the spiritual punishment for Lashon Hara, right? So Miriam was really, because she was on that level, right? Like, you know, leprosy doesn't apply nowadays anymore, because otherwise we'd all be in trouble. But Miriam on her level got very severely punished. Now, God says that she's got leprosy, and she needs to experience what someone with leprosy has, which is she needs to be quarantined outside the camp. She needs to isolate. That was the law with leprosy. And it needs to be for 7 days. That was God's instruction. She needs to be isolated for 7 days. That's her punishment for talking Lashon Hara to Moshe Rabbeinu. So she had to, the Jews were camped in a certain formation. She had to leave the camp and isolate herself outside the camp for 7 days. Then the Pasuk says, an interesting thing, that the Jewish people therefore did not travel for the next 7 days because they're waiting for her. Rashi comes along and quotes a famous piece of the Talmud. That why were they waiting for her? Because it was a reward. Because when Moshe Rabbeinu was born, she waited in the distance, right, to see what was going to happen. So therefore, as a reward, the nation waited for her to be cured of her leprosy before they moved on. Okay. So the Lubavitch Rebbe once asked a very simple question. He says, this makes no sense. What would have happened if she wouldn't have waited for Moshe Rabbeinu? What would have happened if she didn't have that special mitzvah in her bank account? So they wouldn't have waited for her? What was going to happen? She was going to remain outside the camp and they were going to keep going? What? Were they going to leave her there to die? I mean, she couldn't stay alone in the desert. Obviously they had to wait for her. Or travel with her. One of the things. Right? So what actually is going on here? Either it's obvious that we're going to wait for her, or it was obvious they were going to travel with her and she just traveled behind a little bit, right? So why did she need a special mitzvah for this? I mean, obviously she wasn't going to be left there to die herself. I mean, she wasn't going to be going to have 3 million people move on and leave her there in the desert alone. A desert which was filled with elements and animals and snakes and scorpions, as the Torah tells us, right? So what does this all mean? Question clear, yeah? And he said the most amazing insight. He said, no, you have to understand what happened here. God used to tell people to travel. He's telling to camp and then to travel. Throughout the desert, they traveled and stopped and started 42 times. Okay. God said that when Miriam has leprosy, she needs to isolate michutz lamachne, outside the camp, for 7 days, and then she'll be cured from her leprosy. Correct? Which meant, if you look carefully at the words, she needs to isolate outside the camp, which means there needs to be a camp for her to isolate from, correct? Which meant the following. If she wouldn't, it was time for them to travel. It would have been time for them to travel. Had they kept traveling, she would have gone with them. But she wouldn't have been cured in 7 days. It would have taken much longer. Because she would have gone with them, with leprosy, but not fulfilling the instructions to be isolated outside a camp. So she would have to wait till they stop again a few days later or a few weeks later. Formulate the camp, create a camp for then, and then wait the following another 7 days. So of course she wasn't going to be left alone. The only thing is, what would have happened is she would have had her leprosy for a lot longer, because it was time, when she got the leprosy, it was time for them to move on. It was time for them to travel. Had they traveled, she would have traveled behind them, but not fulfilling isolation outside a camp, camp meaning when people are stationary, and therefore have to wait till they become stationary and then start the counting of the 7 days, right? So that's what it means, that she was given the special honor that the entire nation delayed their travel because she should have the discomfort a little less. She should have leprosy only for the 7 days that she was required to and not have it linger on. Why was it given to her? It was given to her, as they explained, because of what she did when Moshe Rabbeinu was a child. Now, what was so great about what she did was a child? What did she accomplish when Moshe Rabbeinu was a child? She accomplished the following. What would have happened? First of all, she had the hope and she was determined. She wanted to see, not to abandon the child. Okay. What would have happened had she not been there? Let's go back to the story. When Pharaoh's daughter found Moshe Rabbeinu, let's say Miriam wouldn't have been there. He still would have been safe. She was a kind-hearted person. She didn't agree with the father's decree. She recognized it was a Jewish child. It says that clearly in the Torah. And she refused to kill him. In fact, there's a medrash that some of her maidservants started to argue with her. Like, how can you do this? Your father wants to kill these kids. So she didn't care. Okay. Right? So what would have happened? What did Miriam being there, what did it accomplish? So this is this idea. What would have happened was the following. So what played out? Batya, the daughter of Pharaoh, saw that the child was hungry. Moshe Rabbeinu was crying. He was hungry. He needed to eat. She tried to feed him. It didn't work. What would have happened had Miriam not been there? Eventually the daughter of Pharaoh would have worked out that she needs to go find a Jewish nurse. Eventually. After a few hours, maybe. She would have figured out what to do. So what did Miriam accomplish? That Moshe Rabbeinu was hungry for a few hours less. That's what she accomplished. She minimized his discomfort. Why? Because she refused to abandon him. It didn't seem like it was going to turn out okay. Putting him in the river didn't seem like a good proposition. It seemed like it was going to be the end of him. But she refused to give up on him. And because she refused to give up on him, actually, what she ended up accomplishing wasn't even that great. It was just about minimizing his hunger for a few hours. And because of that, the entire Jewish nation waited for her for 7 days and didn't travel. Right? And that's Miriam. So Miriam is the refusal to give up, the refusal to abandon someone, the refusal to write something or someone off, and to have the faith and the determination and the hope and encourage other people that it's going to turn out okay. If you ever get to read that book I was talking about before, you'll see. It's interesting. I mean, I was planning to do Miriam. It's interesting because I planned last week to do Miriam already. And then I ended up buying this book after I'd already made the decision. So just amazing how things work out. But you'll see this in concept. And it's amazing what you can accomplish. This Rabbi Grossman in his book brings back hundreds of thousands of people based on the refusal to write people off. First of all, to be like Aaron, to see the neshama, to see the potential, and then to be like Miriam, to put it into practice. To say, no, I'm not just going to believe in him. It's one thing to believe in him and say, you know, to smile at you and I really believe in you and I'm going to... No, but to actually really, really put it into practice and go out of your way to help a person and to implement your belief in the other human being. That's Miriam. And why that's such an incredible part of Jewish history is because there is no Jewish history without the Exodus from Egypt. And there is no nation without the Exodus from Egypt. And it's all because of these three leaders. So yes, Moshe Rabbeinu is of course the most critical role of all, in a way, because we don't have the values, we don't have what the nation stands for. But it's only with the support of Aaron and Miriam, which was the hope and the looking at the good and not giving up, which creates the foundation of the whole destiny of who we are. And that's our lesson, to look at other people that way. Now, we're not all Aaron, Miriam, and Moshe Rabbeinu. We can't all create nations. We're not all Rabbi Grossman's either. We can't create thousands of people, but we can do it with one person. And Miriam, when she did it with one Jewish child, one hungry infant, she had 3 million people wait for her later just to make sure that she'd be discomfort a little bit less. Because the power of not giving up, even on one person, even for a short time, is incredibly powerful. I'll just end very quickly with one final point, and that is just to tie together the whole picture, that although Moshe Rabbeinu's primary function was an instructor and a teacher, it's called Moshe Rabbeinu, yet it's interesting that when Aaron and Miriam passed away, and therefore the water from the and the crowds of glory temporarily disappeared, Moshe Rabbeinu made them come back. Why? Because Moshe Rabbeinu had two things. He was a teacher and he was an ultimate leader. And what the commentaries explain is that a leader is not someone who gets locked into a role. Ultimately, true leadership is that you don't get locked into a particular style or particular role. You do what's needed for the people. And therefore, as long as Aaron and Miriam were alive, Moshe Rabbeinu's primary focus was the man, symbolizing education, symbolizing the teaching and the communication of God's word. But when they were no longer around, and therefore you have to do something else, and you have to be the Miriam, be the Aaron, you're the Miriam and the Aaron, because that's what true leadership is about. So in other words, not only about you can be either or, we're all leaders, as we spoke about many, many times, we're all leaders in our own circle of influence. We have to learn how to be a Moshe Rabbeinu and an Aaron and a Miriam all together. And that's some of the lessons we learn from these amazing people. Okay.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day and a good week, everyone. You're welcome. All the best.
Have a good day.
All the best. Bye bye.
Thank you. See you next week.